Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to welcome back to the Commonwealth Club Mark Shaw. Mark is the best-selling author of The Reporter Who Knew Too Much. Mark is an investigative reporter who has written more than 20 books, including The Poison Patriarch, Miscarriage of Justice, Beneath the Mask of Holiness, Courage in the Face of Evil, and Down for the Count. He's a former legal analyst for USA Today, CNN, and ESPN. Shaw, a member of the Society of Professional Journalists, has written for The Huffington Post, The New York Daily News, USA Today, and The Aspen Daily News. And he's here to speak about his new book, Denial of Justice. Thanks a lot for coming back, Mark.
Thank you, George. Oops. Thank you. On November 8th, 1965, a 52-year-old woman was found dead in her Manhattan, New York townhouse. Between the time her body was discovered, and you'll find out it was discovered twice, and when police arrived 6 hours later, I recently learned that FBI agents swarmed the apartment, the townhouse, and took documents of hers away in boxes. Quickly, an autopsy was conducted with the conclusion that the woman died of barbiturates, a combination of barbiturates and alcohol, circumstances undetermined. Despite this confusing message, no investigation resulted. Nobody stood up for this woman. Nobody questioned the death scene. Not her family, not her friends, not her colleagues, not journalists. Nobody stood up for this woman. More than 10,000 people attended her funeral. But she was buried, and for the next 50 years, it was like she never existed, like she disappeared from the face of the earth, despite her great body of work never given the attention it deserved until now. The name of that woman was Dorothy May Kilgallen, and as you will learn, she was murdered, and for 53 years, she's been denied the justice she deserves.
Time now for everybody's favorite guessing game, What's My Line?
First, the popular columnist whose voice of Broadway appears in papers from coast to coast, Miss Dorothy Kilgallen.
All right, how many people remember her from What's My Line? Well, so did I, and that's all I knew about her. We're going to take our time going through a journey here that I took to learn more about Dorothy, because this is actually the fourth book of mine that has something to do with the JFK assassination. The first one, you may recognize the man I wrote about, Melvin Belli, the San Francisco lawyer. It's called Melvin Belli, King of the Courtroom. I knew about Mr. Belli in the 1980s. I practiced law for a little bit in his building. And I came to find out through that book that Belli had an affinity for the mafia. In fact, one of his colleagues told me Belli loved the mafia and the mafia loved him. He was a bigger-than-life guy. He represented the Rolling Stones, Muhammad Ali, Tammy Faye Baker. You remember her. But his most famous client was Jack Ruby, who you remember shot Lee Harvey Oswald. And when I wrote that book, I learned about a quote that stayed with me, and I'll tell you why it led to the other three books here. But first of all, Belli, I started to question his representation of Jack Ruby, and I want to quickly tell you, if you don't remember, he used a ludicrous psychomotor epilepsy defense, an insanity defense. And second, he would never let Ruby testify. I wondered about that. I'm a curious person like you are. So I started to look further back into what happened with JFK. And I had an advantage there, because as a former criminal defense lawyer and a legal analyst for the big cases of the 21st century and 20th century, I looked at the JFK assassination differently than anybody did. I looked at it as to why Bobby Kennedy wasn't killed instead of why Jack Kennedy was. What I would call, and excuse my English, ass backwards. All right? But it made sense to me, because I learned from the main prosecutor of Jack Ruby, who said to me, well, I was just shocked that JFK got killed, Bobby had many more enemies than Jack Kennedy did. So I went back and I wrote a book called The Poison Patriarch, How the Betrayals of Joseph P. Kennedy Caused the Assassination of JFK. And if you remember, in the 1960 election, Joe Kennedy, the patriarch, knew they were going to lose that election unless they won Illinois and West Virginia. So Joe went to some of his mafia buddies through Frank Sinatra, Sam Giancana, Carlos Marcello, Sandy Trafficante, all those people, and they helped him win that election. Joe had promised them, if they helped, the new administration would leave them alone. And I found a witness, a very respected newspaperman in the Midwest, who was right there the night that Joe Kennedy ordered JFK to appoint who as Attorney General? Bobby Kennedy. And RFK went after those guys with everything he could. He deported Marcello, who we'll talk about later, to Guatemala, the jungles of Guatemala. And you can't mess around with those guys. So they all sought revenge. And so Marcello, who we'll talk about with Dorothy Kilgallen, realizing was the mastermind of the JFK assassination, said to himself, well, if I kill Bobby, JFK will come after me with everything the government has, right? Common sense. But if I kill JFK, Bobby Kennedy will be powerless. And that's exactly what happened. Motive. Look at motive. That's what I did as a former criminal defense lawyer. Motive means opportunity and benefit from the crime. So then I was done. That was enough. But while I was interviewing people for the Belli book, one of them down in San Diego said to me, you know, Belli knew Dorothy Kilgallen. And I said, well, what? He was on What's My Line? The guy said, no, you don't know anything about her. She was this Pulitzer Prize nominated journalist with a column that was syndicated to 200 newspapers across the country. She had a radio show with her husband, listened to by 1 million people in New York City every day. All right? She raised 3 children, and she was an investigative reporter, besides What's My Line, who covered the great trials of the 20th century. Dr. Sam Shepard, remember that one? Became the fugitive movie. The Lindbergh baby kidnapping case. She sat in the front row right behind the guy who was charged with the kidnapping. Lenny Bruce, the free speech case. She actually testified for him in that case. And I said, well, I had no idea about that. He said, well, you should. And I said, fine, thank you. He said, no, I got one more piece of information. When Dorothy died, Melvin Belli said to me, they've killed Dorothy. Now they'll go after Jack Ruby. They've killed Dorothy. Now they'll go after Jack Ruby. Well, I couldn't get that quote out of my mind. So I started on a journey of learning more about Dorothy Kilgallen, her life and times, her death, her investigation of the JFK case, all of that. And it took me on this journey that I'm going to talk to you about tonight and show you then why that led to what I was blessed with, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, which became a bestseller. The movie rights have been purchased and all of that. It was like a godsend. We never had any idea this book would take off, that Dorothy's name was still magic, that people, you know, every author's dream is that the readers will have an emotional contact with the subject you're writing about. I heard from more than 800 people in emails all around the world, Iceland, Argentina, Australia, everywhere, about Dorothy. And they all had tips. Either they knew Dorothy, they knew something about her life and times, they knew something about her death, or they knew something about her JFK assassination. And that's the reason for the birth of this book. That's the reason. And now let's go back into exactly what we need to learn about Dorothy. All right. What's My Line? You can name the panelists like I can, right? Bennett Cerf, all right, Arlene Francis. Those were the normal ones with Dorothy Kilgallen, and then John Daly was the host, right? And what I did with this book is I looked at it as a true crime murder mystery. So there's a lot of suspects in the book, and they start because you kind of think about What's My Line, and people who may have been jealous of Dorothy's popularity on that show. But now we have the voice of Broadway. This was her column, Pulitzer Prize nominated. Here's just some accolades so you realize how big of a media star Dorothy was. How about this? Ernest Hemingway, the greatest woman writer in the world. That's not bad, is it? How about Randolph Hearst? Dorothy had 3 trademarks, a keen mind, a tailored exterior, and a steel rod as a backbone. She was life and death. She reached into the precipices of people's emotions in both her writings and her personal confrontations with her own existence. She was enthusiastic, open, full of life. The New York Post called her the most powerful female voice in America. And on the cover of this book, the New York Daily Post Daily Magazine, wherever Dorothy Kilgallen goes, fame precedes her, envy follows her, and a crowd looks on. She is one of the communications marvel of the ages. That's how big she was. Bigger than Oprah, bigger than Diane Sawyer. I mean, they can't even come close to what this woman accomplished. Okay. So we know about the voice of Broadway. What's the next thing we want to learn about Dorothy? Well, here she is at the Dr. Sam Shepard case. It's my favorite photo. It's up at the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. Look at the all these other reporters gathered around Dorothy. Look at the respect and the admiration they had for this woman of integrity. How many people have said to me, we wish we had a reporter like Dorothy Kilgallen today. Now, let's take that and go with this. Why then did she become obsessed with the JFK assassination? 55th anniversary, by the way, last week, I guess it was, right? 55 years. And let me just speak to that for a minute. A lot of people say, who gives a darn about the JFK assassination? It was 50 years ago. Who cares about Dorothy Kilgallen? She died 50-some years ago. This is history. This is history, and we've got to get history right. And there's so many distortions of history about the JFK assassination, it makes me want to throw up. And I'm going to show you something tonight that will, I believe, shock you and change the way the JFK assassination is looked upon for years to come. For Dorothy, looking into the JFK assassination was not business. It was personal. And it's all because of this little boy. That's her youngest son, Kerry. When Dorothy took Kerry to the White House with her, Pierre Salinger set up an interview kind of fun in the library where JFK surprised the little boy. And he went ahead, and the little boy, Kerry, had brought letters from his third grade class. And JFK made a fuss over all of it, you know, looked at them and everything. Gave him a PT-109 pin. I mean, it was just wonderful. And Dorothy had tears in her eyes, you know, when that happened. The President of the United States, she knew him from social circles. He had actually been to her townhouse and played charades there and all of that. But to make a fuss over her son, just think about the emotion you would have. Well, when JFK died, here's what she wrote in one of her columns. The picture that stays in my mind is the one of a tall young man bending over a small boy, carefully scrutinizing envelopes until he came to the name Kerry Arden Colmer, grade 3B. This is the man who was assassinated in Dallas. And when Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald, I'll tell you what, Dorothy was on the job. She launched an 18-month investigation into the JFK assassination. And what advantages did she have? She had the bully pulpit, didn't she, with her columns and her articles she wrote. She had that national reputation. She had credibility. She had the best sources out there. And that's why she had the advantage over all the other reporters. So she began her research, and that research is what led to her death in 1965. She put herself in danger, as you will find out. Right away, you may remember back then, J. Edgar Hoover was trying to brainwash everybody with this Oswald alone theory, that there was a lone person who killed the President of the United States. You know, he planned all this, this simple man, he planned all this and set it all up in Dealey Plaza and all these other kind of things, shouting that from the ends of the earth, and everybody pretty much bought it. And why did Hoover do that? Because if there was a plot to kill the president, you're not going to hear me say the word conspiracy word, the C word, only this once. I hate that word. It lumps everything together, and it's an easy way of just saying, okay, well, none of that could have happened. Plot to kill the president, all right? If there's a plot to kill the president, then J. Edgar, if it's a nut that killed the president, nobody could have done anything, right? They couldn't have stopped that. But if there's a plot to kill the president, then the FBI is responsible. I don't have much respect for J. Edgar Hoover, but he was a smart man. So what did Dorothy do? She got all this information. She actually went to Dallas. She interviewed the chief of police. In fact, I found, and this is another reader of the book in Dallas, Texas, who sent me this. Retired Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry reveals his personal assassination file. Well, what's the first thing that Dorothy learned from Jess Curry? Do you think that the chief of police sent the officers right after the assassination to the book depository? Here's what it says. Police Radio Channel 2. This is Curry. Go to the hospital, officers. Parkland Hospital. Have them stand by. Get men on top of the underpass. See what happened there. Go to the overpass. This is the kind of thing, you see, that would have been a clue for Dorothy Kilgallen. She would have said, something's wrong here. They're all going toward Oswald, and just 7 days after JFK was killed, she wrote her first scathing column, going to war with J. Edgar Hoover, and here it is. The Oswald file must not close. Just listen to what she wrote. Now, she's the only one who did this. I've had a researcher recently who went to Southern Methodist University and looked in all the papers in Dallas of this time. Nobody else was doing this. It was Dorothy. President Johnson has been elevated so swiftly to his high post that in one sense he has been snatched up in an ivory tower. As chief executive, he is no longer in a position to hear the voice of ordinary people. If he could walk invisible along the streets of the nation and listen to ordinary people talking, he would realize that he must be sure that the mystery of Lee Harvey Oswald is solved and laid before the nation down to the smallest shred of evidence. What is she calling for? An investigation. If Oswald is President Kennedy's assassin, he is the most important prisoner the police in this country have had for 100 years, and no Blythe announcement in Dallas is going to satisfy the American people that this case is closed. Imagine the reaction from Hoover when he reads that column. The case is closed, is it? Well, I'd like to know how, in a big, smart town like Dallas, a man like Jack Ruby, owner of a striptease honky-tonk, can stroll in and out of police headquarters as if it was a health club at a time when a small army of law enforcement officers is keeping a tight security on Oswald. Security, what a word for it. I will not try to speak for the people of Dallas, but around here, the people I talk to really believe that a man has the right to be tried in court. When that right is taken away from any man by an incredible combination of a Jack Ruby and insufficient security, we feel chilled. And here's the quote by Kilgallen that ought to be on her tombstone. In fact, a reader told me that he went to Dorothy's tombstone and laid flowers on there. He loved her so much. What was this quote? Justice is a big rug. When you pull it out from under one man, a lot of others fall too. Just imagine Hoover's reaction to that. That is why so many people are saying there's something unusual about the killing of Oswald, something strange about the way his case is handled, a great deal of missing. The American people have lost a beloved president. It is a dark chapter in our history, and we have a right to read every word of it. It cannot be kept in a file in Dallas. War with Hoover. War with Hoover. So then Dorothy goes ahead, and she won't stop there. She keeps writing these columns. DA to link Ruby and Oswald. I never knew why she was so sure this was going to happen until I was able to secure some documents that you're going to see for the first time tonight that have never been published in any book before. Now I know why she wrote this column, and we'll come back to that. So she went ahead and talks about, in this column, link Ruby to Oswald. Well, again, she's offending Hoover, right? Because they're not supposed to be linked together. And she writes, Ruby has said repeatedly that he doesn't know the alleged assassin of President Kennedy, but then Ruby's plea is temporary insanity. And listen to this. And there are a great many things he doesn't remember and isn't about to. Mark Lane called her the only serious journalist investigating the JFK assassin, and she was. Now, there's this column. Of course, we have the Jack Ruby shooting Oswald. You can never forget seeing that thing. And then there's some contact about, or some talk about her being at the trial and here being a celebrity and the judge calling her in for an autograph and Melvin Belli taking her to an oyster joint and all that kind of thing. And then all that information that she got from the police chief. Now, down through history, all of these so-called experts about the JFK assassination, all these authors, from Stephen King to Gerald Posner and Vincent Bugliosi and Bill O'Reilly and all these people. None of them ever even mentioned Dorothy. They never did their research. They never investigated. Most of them said she was never even at the trial. Well, who's she standing there with? Melvin Belli at the trial. And at the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, you can see that's coming to a news conference, and they both speak at the news conference. Experts say she wasn't even there. Distortion of history. Here she is whispering into the ear of the co-counsel, Joe Tannehill, for Jack Ruby. She was then, you talk about celebrity status, 400 reporters at that trial. Who's the only one who interviewed Jack Ruby twice? Dorothy Kilgallen. And we can show you exactly what we believe was a little bit about that particular interview. And I should say to you that I really was fortunate here, because every author gets to a point writing a book where they wonder if they have enough material for the book. And that happened to me, and I will tell you right now something, and you may think I'm wacky, but I will. I believe Dorothy Kilgallen chose me to write her story. I believe she chose me to be her voice. I believe that she guided me along with almost everything that I found for either of the two books, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much or Denial of Justice. And she certainly sent me to an article that was in a Midwest Today magazine. And there I went and I found out that there had been two interviews with her two hairdressers, her best friend, one of the contestants on her last What's My Line program, and a person who had provided a lot of material about Dorothy and was able to give information that would make a difference with her case. So I called this publisher here of that article, and he said, yes, I have those interviews, but Mr. Shaw, those people are dead. And I thought, oh, no, I can't talk to him. He said, I have good news. The interviews were videotaped. And I found the woman in Los Angeles who had them. My wife knows it took me, I don't know how many months, to get this woman to trust me with those videotapes, and finally I got them. They're all up on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. There must be 30 or 40 up there. Well, let's hear from Joe Tannehill, because he was one of the people that was interviewed in that article as well. Here he talks about the importance of Jack Ruby giving an interview to Dorothy Kilgallen. And I just hope you'll think about this. This is history. This is primary source material. I don't speculate in my books. I try to find primary sources. Well, you can't get any more primary than what Joe Tannehill is going to tell you right now.
He wasn't uttering nonsense because this interview with her was a very significant point in his classless life, you know. And I think he enjoyed it very much and cooperated with her in every way that he could, and told her the truth as he understood it. And it was just a very agreeable conversation between them, and I just can't understand people doubting the sincerity of that interview, because it was, to me, I watched them, and it was a very sincere discussion going back and forth.
In the Denial of Justice book, there is a photograph of the Ruby trial courtroom. This interview took place, excuse me, right behind a railing. You can see right where it took place. Joe Tannehill, confirms that occurred.
Earl Ruby would make that statement.
That's all right. That's all right. So it confirms it. And what's interesting about that is, I don't know if you know who Vincent Bugliosi was, but he prosecuted Charles Manson, and he wrote a book about twice as thick as this, all right? In there, actually, I knew him, and I told him about Dorothy. And he never talked about her in there, but only to say she never interviewed Jack Ruby. Distortion of history. So let's build the drama just a little bit. We know Dorothy is what? In the front row at the Jack Ruby trial. She's learning about what's going on. She's watching the testimony. She's picking up all the nuances of any evidence that's going on there. She now has met Ruby, And now she has gone ahead and interviewed him. She's getting all this material in her mind. She's writing these columns. You've got to know that enemies are circling because she's going against the grain, isn't she? She's putting herself at risk. In my opinion, she's sealing her fate. Then she wrote this column on Ruby. And I'll tell you what, I have such admiration for Dorothy, and especially as a wordsmith. If I could write half as well as she did, I'd have had 25 bestsellers. Listen to this prose. Nervous Ruby near breaking point and her visualization. Jack Ruby's eyes were as shiny brown and white bright as the glass eyes of a doll. He tried to smile, but his smile was a failure. When we shook hands, his hand trembled in mine ever so slightly, like the heartbeat of a bird. Isn't that beautiful, beautiful writing? I'm nervous and worried, he told me. I feel I'm on the verge of something I don't understand. The breaking point, when she said to him, I think you're holding up pretty well, he said, I'm fooling you, Dorothy. I'm really scared. And then again, we're going to connect this in with what I'm going to show you later on. She wrote, I went out into the almost empty lunchroom corridor, wondering what I really believed about Jack Ruby. Notice she never talks about Oswald, all right? She believed Oswald was a dead end, confused. What could you say about him? You could never prove anything. And yet that's who everybody always focused on. She focused on Jack Ruby. And then, Dorothy, boy, you talk about infuriating the powers that be. Think about the Pentagon Papers. Think about the Nixon White House tapes. Think about Snowden and the NSA exposure of the secrets there. Well, Dorothy Kilgallen exposed Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission before it was supposed to be released. She had somebody at the Warren Commission who snuck this material that Ruby had talked about. I compare her to Katharine Graham a little bit with the Pentagon Papers and the paper and Katharine Graham having to decide whether to publish those, because if you even saw the film or know about that, the White House was going to destroy the Washington Post if they did that. Well, J. Edgar Hoover threatened to do the same thing with the New York Journal American. And that publisher backed Dorothy Kilgallen, and she exposed these. And I have some proof of what Hoover thought about it, because I was able to secure from the National Archives a letter from J. Edgar Hoover to the Warren Commission that has never been seen before. And again, you know, I don't want to be disrespectful, but all this is hiding in plain sight for 50 years. I'm not the greatest researcher that ever lived, but I found it. Here it is, Hoover letter to the Warren Commission. What did he do? He sent a couple, I like to look at it this way. He sent these big, tough thugs, these FBI agents, over to Dorothy's fancy townhouse, you know, five floors and you know, beautifully decorated and everything else. And they go over there, and here's little pint-sized Dorothy sitting on the couch in one of her What's My Line outfits, okay? And they interrogate her. You've got to tell us who your source was. You've got to tell us what happened and all this, all right? Well, they come back to J. Edgar Hoover with their tail between their legs. And in the memo, it says, Hoover wrote that Kilgallen refused to reveal the source, but acknowledged it was a responsible person who had a legal right to the transcript. She told the agent she was the only person who knew the identity of the source, and then listen to this integrity, and that she would rather die than reveal his identity. That's the kind of person Dorothy Kilgallen was. We're now 16 months, since this is August 24th, 1964, before Dorothy Kilgallen is dead. By the way, we can just talk about it right now if you want to. Dorothy Kilgallen was never called before the Warren Commission. She's not even mentioned in there. This thing is just the biggest joke in the world, and she knew it. She called it laughable, and it is. And yet people today still believe all of the junk that is in there. Okay, what'd she do now? She kept writing those columns. She wasn't going to give up. War with Hoover escalates. Apparently Hoover made it known that he was really upset with her. What she wrote is, from what I've read, I've been inclined to believe the FBI might be more profitably employed in probing the facts of the JFK assassination rather than how I got them, which does seem a waste of time to me. And then again, she just drives this stake right into J. Edgar Hoover's heart and into anybody who was involved with the JFK assassination. And at any rate, the whole thing smells a big fishy. It's a mite too simple that a chap kills the President of the United States, escapes from that, kills a policeman if he did, eventually is apprehended in a movie theater under circumstances that defy every law of police procedure, and subsequently is murdered under extraordinary circumstances. Common sense, right? Common sense. Made no sense. That's for sure. All right. She kept going. She called the Warren Commission, its decision laughable. And now we're getting to, even closer to the time when she's going to die. And you have to know that an announcement was made at that particular point. What was it? This is what just completely sealed her fate. Bennett Cerf, who was on What's My Line, remember what else he did? He was the publisher of Random House. He hired Dorothy to write a book about the JFK assassination. It was all over the papers. Wow, just imagine what J. Edgar Hoover and Marcello and all those guys thought of this. She's going to publish the truth. And remember, for later on here, she was in the front row at the Jack Ruby trial. Putting that target right on her back, isn't she? All right, so now we can kind of get a little bit of an idea of what it was all about with Dorothy's investigation from these two hairdressers, Mark Sinclair and Charles Simpson. They were pretty much her closest friends, although I was able to interview Dorothy's butler's daughter, Barbara DeJordan, who gave me that information about the FBI agents swarming the townhouse, because Barbara and her brother and her mother and father lived in the townhouse on the first floor, an apartment there. They knew what was going on. And I'll tell you just a little bit about that in a bit. But let's go ahead and let's get to getting an idea about some things that both of these hairdressers can tell us. Again, these are eyewitnesses to history. All right? Let's start with Mark Sinclair and talking about what Dorothy said about her JFK assassination investigation.
She wouldn't stop on it. Pre-Warren exclusive, yeah. So she had it all. And she told me all about this, and she told Donnell was there too, so I mean, he knew. We knew what she was doing.
At this time, did
she said that this would be the case of a lifetime, a story of a lifetime, that she would prove that the president was assassinated. Who assassinated the president?
She would prove who assassinated the president of the United States. She had it all. Donnell, by the way, is Charles Simpson. That's who he's talking about, his fellow hairdresser. Then we have to think about, was Dorothy scared? Was she afraid? Going to war with the second most powerful man in the United States, maybe the most powerful, because, as you know, J. Edgar Hoover had all this dirt on the Kennedys. That's why he kept his job so long. All right, was she scared? Let's hear Mark Sinclair.
Around this time, you used to get her ready for What's My Line show, and you would sometimes play the game of What's My Line.
Yeah, I played it all the time, yes.
Where you would pretend to be a contestant, mm-hmm. like you made.
We would play the game. Donnell was there, and we would play the game around her.
While you were playing the game once, did she ever say something out of the blue about threats on her life?
Yes. She told me that this is a couple of weeks before she died, or maybe 3 or 4 weeks before she died. I'm not sure the time anymore. But she told me she was going to get a gun because her life was being threatened, and she was scared for her life and for her family.
I'll tell you what scared her. And those people who ended up, as we will talk about, poisoning Dorothy Kilgallen with not one but three barbiturates. They wanted to threaten her. They wanted to scare her. And what could they do that could hurt Dorothy Kilgallen? Well, she woke up one morning and looked at the newspaper, and there was a picture of little Carrie running across Central Park. And she just went out of her mind. She couldn't believe it because she knew somebody was following Carrie around. She was so scared, Mark Sinclair says in another interview, that Halloween was a couple days away. She sent Carrie around doing Halloween and trick-or-treat in a limousine with a bodyguard. Mark Sinclair went with her to New Orleans, where she was going to tie together Oswald, Marcello, and Jack Ruby. And they went down on separate planes. And then she called him down there at the hotel and said, go back to New York City. Don't tell anybody you were here. And don't ask any more questions. She knew the target was on her back. Now let's see what Charles Simpson had to say. He is aware of her working on the JFK assassination.
Did you have the feeling that she was investigating the murder case of Jack Ruby killing Oswald and Oswald killing Kennedy? Was she digging into that?
She never quit. She never quit. She dug up something. She dug up something about the assassination of President Kennedy that somebody didn't want her to know, because she even told us of her own volition. She said, I used to share things with you guys, and she said, but after I have found out now what I know, she said, if the wrong people knew what I know, it would cost me my life. And she was dead about 9 months later.
If the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it could cost me my life. Wrong people. And then Charles Simpson gives us another insight into Dorothy.
She had a copy of Warren Commission testimony sometime before.
She printed it on... She printed on the front page of the Journal American before the president received it. And therein lies the tale. From then on, we were stalked.
Who's we?
Mark, myself, our phones were tapped. They were trying to find out where she got her information from. That she could get this information before the president got it. It was then President Johnson.
Talk about a scoop, huh? Well, she's going back to New Orleans again. She'd been there once. She'd connected Marcello, Ruby, and Oswald, my belief, and I've confirmed that in the book with another eyewitness account. She told her makeup man Carmen Gebbia, yes, about going to, when he asked, is it Kennedy? Yes, and it's very cloak and daggerish. I'm going to meet a source whom I do not know but will recognize, who will give me information about the case. To her lawyer, she said, I'm going to break the real story and have the biggest scoop of the 20th century. She's working on that book. There's a photo of her in the Ruby trial in the courtroom of her holding her JFK file. All those notes are in there, all of that. So then what do we know that Dorothy was doing up until November 8, 1965? She was planning a trip to London. She was working on the tell-all book, she called it, for Random House. She had movie deals in place for the book. She had lunch planned for a friend on the 8th of November. By the way, there were those who thought Dorothy Kilgallen could have committed suicide. Makes absolutely no sense for several reasons in both books. Sinclair then arrives at the townhouse to get her ready for What's My Line. He fixes her hair, flowers in it, helps with makeup, false eyelashes, and so on. She dresses for the show. She goes to the show. Sinclair notices she's wearing a different dress than she had on before. The show is over. She heads to P.J. Clark's, which is a tavern in New York City. I sat right next to the table where she was on the last night of her life. Then she goes to the Regency Hotel bar for a drink with what we called a mystery man, although we now know who that mystery man is. And then Mark Sinclair explains what happened on the morning of the 8th of November, 1965.
Did she tell you what her plans were for later that night after What's My Line?
She was going home afterwards. Well, but obviously she didn't, because she went to the Regency.
Do you suspect that she got a phone call after you left?
After I left, I think she got a phone call from somebody. And she agreed to meet whoever it was at the Regency. That's my belief. Because she wasn't going to Clark's. She had asked me if I wanted to meet her because she did not have anybody she was going to meet with. And she was not dressing for a date.
Well, she did end up going to Clark's briefly with Bob Bogg.
Well, maybe, but not long. But she would have, she might have done that and then gone home, but there wouldn't have been an evening like she had.
Why didn't you accept her offer to go with her somewhere?
I was tired myself. She had done something every day that week, and she had more appointments for me the following week. And I didn't want to see anymore. I wanted to go home.
Did she tell you that she had a meeting at her son's school the next
Yes, week? On that was Sunday. I did her hair before the show. And she told me to come the next morning before 9. I arrived at the house at 9, used my key, I think it was about 8:30, 8:45, used my key, let myself in, went upstairs, and Dorothy was dead in her bedroom.
You went to the third floor bedroom that she did not sleep in that room.
She did not sleep in that room, and when I entered, Dorothy was... She was not in that room, but the air conditioning was on. It was cold out. That's the room.
What about that air conditioning vent? Was that...
No, that's the dressing room. Oh, no. That's a heater. That's not an air conditioner. This is the air conditioner.
Oh, that's where it would have been in that position.
Right in that same position. And it was blowing out in that room. And I was here. And the light was on, and she wasn't there. So I turned on my curling irons, and I walked into the bedroom, not thinking that she would be there. And she was sitting up in bed, and I walked over to the bed and touched her, and I knew she was dead right away.
And how was the bed made up?
The bed was spotless. She was dressed very peculiarly. She was dressed like I've never seen her before. She always dressed in pajamas and old socks, and her makeup was off, and her hair was off, and everything was done. She was completely dressed like she was going out. The hair was in place, the makeup was on, the false eyelashes were on, the matching peignoir and robe, book laid out on the bed, a drink on the table, the light was on, the air conditioning was on. Though you didn't need an air conditioner, you would have had the heat on. And she was always cold. And why she had the air conditioning on, I don't know.
Possibly someone else had turned it on.
Well, maybe to keep the body a certain temperature. You know.
Was the glass on the bedside table within her reach?
It was on the right-hand side. No, it was way away, way over. And the book, it was turned upside down. It wasn't in the right position for if you'd been reading, laid it down. And it was laid down so perfectly, you know, like that. And one hand, rigor mortis had set in on one hand, the right hand. And it had drawn up the covers a little bit. And there was lipstick on this sleeve of the bolero jacket. And the light was on, and she was sitting up.
A couple comments about that. First of all, with Simpson and Sinclair, you notice, you know, how credible they sound. The interviewer is not putting words in their mouth. You know, they correct them when there's something wrong. That's why I think this is so important. The second thing is, what happened? Okay, what happened? Well, we found out that the body was, first of all, found in the bathroom, not in the bedroom, and it was moved. And I'll leave that for you to read in the book as to how that happened. But then what happens? Well, the police don't come because they didn't call the police for almost 6 hours. And we now know that FBI agents, or those who were posing as FBI agents, came and took away Dorothy's documents, including this file she had on the JFK assassination. It's missing. It's never been found, although I'll tell you in a little bit. I think I know where it is, and I tried to get it. All right? So now the police come, and they take a look at this. Well, does that sound like look like a staged death scene to you? If they even ask around. A woman like Dorothy Kilgallen, false eyelashes, makeup, her hairpiece on. She doesn't have her usual things she wears to bed. The book on her lap is upside down. They couldn't find her reading glasses. She'd already read that book. Somebody staged that death scene, didn't they? But what do the police do? Well, they see an empty vial of Seconal tablets on a table, and they decide, well, you know what? She must have died of an overdose of barbiturates. And I know she drank vodka and tonics, so probably that's what killed her. And so they leave. There's no investigation of any kind. In fact, the medical examiner who's called doesn't come from Manhattan. Dorothy's in Manhattan. It comes from Brooklyn. And in the two books I've proven, especially in the second one, the one in Brooklyn was mafia-controlled. makes you wonder, all this covering up, anything to do with Dorothy, all right?
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
The two detectives come, they find that. All right, now we have the autopsy report. Well, again, you know, it's tough to take credit for some of these things because it seems to me like somebody else would have done this, but why not try to find Dorothy's autopsy report? Here it is. I found it. National Archives again. Wasn't hiding from anybody, but nobody even wanted to look for all these years. They just accepted that Dorothy Kilgallen was what? A druggie and an alcoholic. And that's what was printed on the front pages. Basically, she died of a barbiturate overdose and an alcoholic. What? My God, look at that reputation tainted there of this remarkable woman. Well, I started looking at this autopsy report, and a friend of mine named Randy Boris, who's a pharmacologist, we looked at it, and we looked down through there. Well, sure, it said secanol in there, but right below it was written the words Tylenol. Well, Tylenol is a step up from secanol in terms of sleeping pills. So now there's two barbiturates in her system, all right? Now, I found the son of a toxicologist in the medical examiner's office who told me that his father and another toxicologist, that toxicologist kept Dorothy's bodily liquids for 3 years, thinking that the techniques would improve and they could look at them. Guess what happened when they finally analyzed, though? They found phenobarbital as well. Three barbiturates. Accidental death, my you know what. This was murder. And that glass, by the way, we proved in the books there was a residue on that glass, which meant however that those barbiturates were ingested, they were ingested in what? Powder form. Powder form. Either at the Regency Hotel bar or at home, whoever was with Dorothy was able to poison those drinks, and that's what killed her. Well, Dr. Luke, with his great autopsy report, he would, in the New York Times, it said, Dr. Luke would not speculate about the form in which Miss Kilgallen had taken the barbiturates. Well, we'd rather leave that up in the air. We just don't want to give that out. Well, just because. How'd you like to have him involved with the autopsy of a friend of yours? All right, 10,000 people turned out for Dorothy's funeral. But nobody stood up for her. Not her family, not her mother and father, not her children, not her What's My Line colleagues, not her New York Journal American, colleagues there. Nobody. They just accepted that. Imagine that. I mean, you want to, if something happens to you, you want people to at least say, hey, that doesn't sound like what that person would do, correct? We'd like to have that happen if something like that happened to us. Nobody did that. And I can tell you, for a long time, took me, I wondered why. And you're asking yourself why. Well, here's what I think. They all knew she was involved in the JFK assassination investigation, right? So they're saying to themselves, and I don't think this is an excuse, but they're saying to themselves, if the same people who killed JFK killed Dorothy Kilgallen, I am not about to get involved. And none of them did. None of them stood up for Dorothy. Okay, so what did I do? Well, I decided to see, against all odds, if I could get the New York District Attorney's Office to investigate Dorothy's death. No investigation in 65, cover up, let's see. I wrote this letter to him in January of 2017. Everybody told me I was crazy, but I keep trying things that, you know, you never know what's going to happen if you don't try. Well, in January of 2018, New York Post posted an article. It said, the DA will investigate. Sue Edelman wrote it, and there were 200. You talk about Dorothy's popularity. There were 235,000 hits on the online story. So many people were just so happy that Dorothy Kilgallen was finally going to get the justice she deserved. There was going to be this thorough investigation for sure. And to that end, I spent months with the chief investigator for the New York District Attorney's Office, giving him all of the new evidence that I had found, since the reporter who knew too much. Emailed back and forth, and I told him about different things I'd found. I told him about the fact that there were two accounts of Dorothy's daughter saying, "My mother was murdered." There was an account of Jill, the daughter's best friend, saying she heard Dorothy was quieted. Had all this evidence proving that Dorothy was murdered. I was on cloud nine. I went to New York City. I met with the DA's investigator at their offices downtown. And right away, he kept calling Dorothy a victim of a crime. He said, "You know, I wonder whether that boyfriend of hers, his name is Ron Pataki, that we'll talk about, could have sold her JFK assassination evidence to the wrong people. I'm so excited because we usually handle embezzlement cases. My father's so excited, he started watching the reruns of What's My Line." When I walked out of that meeting, I thought, my goodness sakes, we're going to get justice for Dorothy. All right. So everything seemed in pretty good shape. And why? One of the main reasons was that I had found a lot of evidence about this man, Ron Pataki. And you're going to see now, this is a poem that Ron Pataki was conveniently came into Dorothy's death right about the same time as the Jack Ruby trial. And he latched on to her. He was much younger than she was. He was a real hunk. We'll show you a photograph of him in a minute. But he got into Dorothy's camp, and they ended up having a love affair. He denied the love affair, of course, but there was one. And she made a big mistake. She started sharing with him material from her JFK assassination investigation. All right? We know that about Ron Pataki. He was a Midwestern journalist. He wasn't well-to-do. He was a wannabe who wanted to be a big name, and he was going to use Dorothy to get that big name. And so I investigated Ron Pataki. I was able to interview him a couple times. He ends up in so many ways being a pathological liar with psychopathic tendencies. He cannot tell the truth. Inconsistency. Was I with Dorothy the night she died? No, I wasn't. Was I? Did I help her with the investigation? No. You know, all these inconsistencies that you can read in denial of justice. But here was the evidence over the top. And when I showed this to the chief investigator, his mouth was open. Look at these. She wrote two poems. Let me just tell you the first one, and then we'll read the second one. He wrote a poem called "Never Trust a Stiff at a Typewriter." There's a way to quench a gossip stench that never fails. One cannot write if zippered tight. Somebody who's dead can tell no tales. Who does that sound that's like that's about? Well, Ron Pataki was worried because Dorothy finally realized, Mark Sinclair will tell you in a videotaped interview, she knew he was leaking her JFK assassination material to the wrong people, and she was going to expose him. Never trust a stiff at a typewriter. There's a way to quench a gossip stench that never fails. One cannot write if zippered tight. Somebody who's dead can tell no tales. And then this one. Vodka roulette, seen as a relief possibility. While I'm spilling my guts, now think about this as we go along, she is driving me nuts. Please fetch us two drinks on the run. Just skip all the noise and make one of them poison, and don't even tell me which one. The reason that is so overwhelming is because when you're a homicide detective, you want to look into the fact of you want to look into facts that only the killer could know. This was never divulged before he wrote this poem. He's basically describing how Dorothy was killed, isn't he? Well, when I showed that to the DA's investigator, I thought, man, they're going to go out and put that guy in handcuffs. No question about it. So you know who killed Dorothy Kilgallen? We have all these suspects and everything else like that. But Pataki certainly had the motive. And in the second book here, again, I present all of these suspects for you to take a look at. So let's look at the second book, and we can go through some things that I think are very, very important to understanding now the truth about the JFK assassination and who killed Dorothy Kilgallen. I was able to find there are about four reasons why I wrote it, and I heard from all these people, as I told you, around the world. I found the butler's daughter, and she was able to tell me about parties at Dorothy's house, Dorothy's habits. They're keeping champagne at the ready, expensive gifts that came back from Europe, her shoe collection that she had, autographed shoes, Johnny Mathis that I was able to confirm with his friend. She mentioned the FBI swarming the day, the townhouse on the day that Dorothy died. All of that material was really important. I also found out about 40 new images about Dorothy that are in the book. And here's one that you'll really enjoy. This is Dorothy with who? Marilyn. And she didn't believe that the truth about Marilyn came out in the investigation. But I've got her with Hemingway. I've got her with George Harrison. I've got her with her Hollywood star she had, with legendary, this is important here. I got her with legendary actress Betty Davis at Warner Brothers. The date is 1935, all right? Dorothy is 22 years old at the time. And 4 years earlier, she was a college dropout. What an inspiration she is to young journalists. I've heard from young journalists, especially women, you know, who just inspired by Dorothy. 4 years later, she's sitting at Warner Brothers with Betty Davis. How's that? I've even got her at the Truman White House in the front row, a few steps away from Truman. Then, the second reason really for writing the book, I found more information about this man. That's Ron Pataki. More violence in his background about with women. Anna Maria Alberghetti threw a glass table at her. Jim Otis, the football player, he got in a altercation at a bar with. His admission that he went to an assassin school in Central America after flunking out of Stanford. Yeah, admitted it. Statement to family members that I found through readers again that Pataki admitted he was the last person to see Kilgallen alive. And he admitted the poems were about Dorothy. Pathological liar with psychopathic tendencies. That's who Ron Pataki is, and he is free today, and I will tell you why. In August of last year, I said they set up a phone call with me and the chief investigator and the assistant district attorney, Eugene Hurley, assigned to the case, updating the investigation. I thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to find out exactly what they found. I never wanted them to solve the case. I wanted them to at least admit that Dorothy had been murdered and then look into solving the case. Right away, I knew something was wrong. Hurley says to me, you know, Mr. Shaw, we've looked into this, and we can find no evidence that Dorothy Kilgallen was harmed by others. And my jaw dropped, and I almost wanted to throw up right there. And I said, what? All the evidence I gave you in the evidence report and all these witnesses and all these documents? Well, Mr. Shaw, we couldn't find any harm. I said, what? He said, Mr. Shaw, I am not going to argue with you. And besides that, we don't know who did it. I said, wait a minute, you just contradict yourself. I'm not going to argue with you about this. So they pulled the plug on the investigation. That was it. Well, in the statement that they put out, it said that they pulled the plug, no harm. There were so many people upset with this, including me. But they also said, if Mr. Shaw, you bring new evidence to us, we'll reopen the investigation. So I said, okay, I'll go after it, and I did. I've just talked to you about some of the material that I found. And I found more information about Dorothy's death, more information about the suspect, all kinds of things. And then I hit a gold mine. A lawyer down in Fresno called me one day and he said, Mr. Shaw, I don't know if you know about this, but I have a gift for you. And I said, what's that? His name's Greg Mullinix. I said, no, Greg, what do you have? He said, I have something that's going to change everything. And I said, well, I'm certainly interested in that. And he said, Mr. Shaw, I have the 2,000 pages of the Ruby trial transcripts. Right there they are, foot and a half tall, 2,000 pages, never published before in a book. Nobody took the time to look to find them, including me, okay? 2,000 pages. Took me 2.5 weeks to go through them, and I went through them very carefully. Why? Because I knew Dorothy Kilgallen was sitting in that front row. She was listening and watching to testimony from eyewitnesses in 1963 when President Kennedy was killed. Front row, what did she learn? Well, we can look at the revelations in here, and I just want to give you a couple because I think they will shock you as they did me. Jack Ruby, remember, always said that he just happened to be down at the Western Union office. It was right across from the Dallas Police Department basement. He just happened to walk in there. He just happened to shoot Lee Harvey Oswald. That's what Hoover fed to us all these years, and every single so-called expert just believed it, swallowed that lie, the biggest lies in the history. And here's the proof in these documents, and you can come up and just take a look at them if you want to. All right, there's a witness, Don Campbell, advertising salesman, Dallas Morning News. Mr. Campbell, where was Jack Ruby in the office at the time that you left at 12:25? Now, this is the Dallas Morning News offices near Daly Plaza, very near, I will tell you. He was sitting at a desk directly behind mine belonging to Mr. John Newman. And what was he doing when you saw him? He was writing some copy for his nightclub act. And I will ask you if the corner, now listen to this. And I will ask you if at the corner of the second floor office, from which it was possible to see the Texas School Book, And I will ask you if at the corner of the second floor office, from which it is possible to see the Texas School Book Depository, a Mr. Jeffries has a small glassed-in office there. Now try to visualize that, okay? Yes, he has. And I will ask you if standing outside Mr. Jeffries' door, looking through that second window from the corner, is it possible to see the Texas School Book Depository? Yes, most of the building. Now, what time here in Dallas was the president assassinated? According to newspaper stories, 12:35. About 12:35, and Jack was with you from 12 to 12:25, is that right? Yes, sir. And then you left just before the assassination. So we know what? Ruby was there at 12:25, a few minutes before JFK was assassinated. There's an office there with glass. The window faces what? Daly Plaza. So then they called prosecution witness John Newman, the retail advertising man. And what time did you arrive back at your office? Approximately 12:40. At the time that you went back to your office, did you know the president had been shot? I did not. You arrived at your office. I will ask you if you saw the defendant in this case, Jack Ruby. Yes, I did. Do you see him in the courtroom? And if anything, with regard to getting up to late news, did he look out that window toward Daly Plaza at that time when the assassination was happening? Yes, he did. Jack Ruby knew about the JFK assassination before it happened. And Dorothy Kilgallen knew that, didn't she? And she was going to put that in her book. The second one. This is maybe even more stunning. There's also testimony in... Well, no, let me go to this. All right. Then this is a witness who has a parking lot right across from Jack Ruby's Carousel Club. Directing your attention to the 23rd Saturday after the assassination of Kennedy, did you see the defendant Jack Ruby on that occasion? Yes, I did. What parking lot was that? I have a parking lot called the Nichols Brother Parking, 1320 Commerce Street. Ruby parked his car there for 3 years, right? Yes. And his place of business is close by, across the street. The 23rd of Saturday afternoon, about 2:50, did Ruby come across the street to use the public telephone? Yes, he did. Did you listen to the conversation? Yes, I did. What did he say in reference to having been a reporter with a pencil and notebook, making like a reporter to get into the Dallas Police Department offices on the Friday when they had the Oswald news conference, and as far as him getting into the basement to kill Oswald? He was making like a reporter, yes. And then it goes on, and this is the most important one. Did Ruby say anything on the phone, reference to whether, concerning whether he would be there, asking about the transfer, he would be there? What did he say on that? He told whoever he was talking to that he would be there. Yes, he would be there. Jack Ruby stalked Lee Harvey Oswald from the moment he was arrested. Dorothy connected all that in. Then she connected in Marcello in New Orleans, and all of this was going to be in her book. Talk about being in danger. Dorothy Kilgallen was, because she was searching for the truth and she would let nothing stop her. It's all in here. primary source, witnesses. I also proved in the book that Melvin Belli also knew about the Jack Ruby, about the JFK assassination before it happened. A witness was with Belli over here at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, and a waiter came up and said, "Well, you might want to know that Lee Harvey Oswald was just shot and killed." And Ruby and Belli said, "Well, good. Now I'll have to represent Jack Ruby." Belli knew about it as well. There's evidence in there that Ruby admitted that the Dallas Police Department officers helped him get in the basement. It's all in there. This is irrefutable evidence. Destroys anything about Oswald alone that has ever been it's been percolated for all these years. A couple of final notes. I decided that I wanted Caroline Kennedy to know about what I had found out about Dorothy Kilgallen. I wanted her to meet Dorothy Kilgallen. So I sent her a copy of the book. And in there, I said, "My intention is to make you aware, if you're not already, of this remarkable woman, Dorothy Kilgallen, who broke the glass ceiling before the term was even fashionable, raising three children while being engaged in several careers. Like your father, Dorothy, a college dropout who overcame gender bias, she believed in justice and the backbone of integrity with every cause she pursued. There was certainly a bond of respect between them. I trust you and Dorothy may share the same bond." And then I said, "Perhaps what you will read in the book will provide some closure for you, Ed, Rose, Tata, Jack, and Titania, but especially for you, since I was so taken with your heartwarming statement in a 2017 tribute video to your father when you said, 'I think of him every day.' Blessings to you and your family. Dorothy loved your father, and he was certainly a hero of mine. It is truly unfortunate that we don't have reporters like Dorothy and leaders like your father to guide our path today. As of yet, I have not heard from her." So I want to play for you just one quick video and then a final comment. Dorothy Kilgallen loved life. Just think about what would have happened if she had lived and published that book. We wouldn't have had this greatest murder mystery in history. All of that would have gone by the wayside because she was going to print the truth. She was going to expose all of this material when nobody else had the guts to do so. But what of her careers? What's My Line? The radio show? All the things that she had. What was the one thing that she loved more than any? Please. Hear from her.
Dorothy, if you had to be confined to one job of the many that you do, which would it be?
Well, Ed, I love television. I have so much fun on What's My Line, playing the game, and I love our morning radio program, too. But I think that I would have to settle for my first love and my true love, the newspaper business. It still has me and always will, I think, I hope.
Well,
this is a Dorothy Kilgallen to be remembered, a patriot, a woman who went after the truth at every occasion of her life. Who was loved by her friends and other people in her family, who was the epitome of integrity as a reporter, that she was killed. You know, I spent, 14, 15 years now looking into the JFK assassination. It took this long for me to get to this point where I can say the things I did to you today. And I have the advantage, don't I? Because I've had Dorothy Kilgallen right beside me, guiding me along with this. And so I will leave you with this, and I will say it, and then if you want to say it with me, you can. Justice for Dorothy Kilgallen. Justice for Dorothy Kilgallen. Thank you.
Mr. Shaw already gave me permission to ask this question, yes. So he knows what it is. And that is
the best way.
Just recently, the film Can You Ever Forgive Me came out about Lee Israel, who also wrote a biography about Dorothy Kilgallen, I think 1979. And I asked you earlier if you could comment about that, if pros or cons of that, and how you feel about it.
Thank you. I'd advise anybody to take a look at that film. It's Melissa McCarthy was born to play that role. It was tough for me to watch. Lee Israel is the only other person who ever wrote a biography of Dorothy Kilgallen in the 1970s. It's a good biography. Unfortunately, she didn't have a lot of the information that I was able to secure, the testimony of the two hairdressers and others and things like that. She didn't find anything about this. Nobody else ever has. It's a tough film to watch, but she was a gutsy broad. I think that's what you would call her. It was disappointing because in that movie, as you may know, they make her into a real sourpuss, that she wasn't a very nice person. She forged some letters of famous people and got arrested and all of that. It's just unfortunate she had that downside to her life. But I try to look at the best in everybody, and she believed in Dorothy, and she believed Dorothy had been murdered. And so I have all the respect in the world for her that she wrote that book.
About the Ruby trial, I read several times that Ruby had requested that he be transferred to Washington, I think, to D.C., yeah, to do his testimony there because he was worried about where he was, and they refused permission for him to go there. And so he knew, supposedly, that his goose was cooked. So my question is, when Dorothy was there and she spoke to him privately, I'm just wondering, is there any way to know whether he actually told her anything that he might have wanted to talk about in Washington, or did he just...
Well, unfortunately, since her file disappeared, and I should have mentioned in here, I think the New York District Attorney's Office found it. I think they have it. I'm going to keep after it. I just sent a letter. I guess we forgot that. I sent a letter to the New York Attorney General asking them to investigate the New York City District Attorney's conduct in their investigation, the bogus investigation, okay? We don't have her file. I believe she had her notes in there of speaking with Ruby. All that we can figure out is what she did after she talked to Ruby. She didn't stay in Dallas and investigate LBJ, did she? She didn't go to Washington and investigate him. She didn't go to Washington and look in the CIA. Where'd she go? New Orleans. She saw this as a mob hit start to finish. Marcello masterminds the assassination of JFK. Bobby Kennedy is powerless. They catch Oswald, who's a bit player. Now you got to silence him. You bring in the mafia wannabe, Ruby, and kill Oswald. Then you bring in the mafia lawyer, Melvin Belli, and you silence Jack Ruby. But you have to remember, everything that Ruby said after his trial was discounted by all of us because what? We thought he was nuts. And that's what J. Edgar Hoover, and that's what I believe Belli wanted us to believe. So you couldn't believe anything he said. And that's why I don't think they were going to permit him to come to Washington, D.C. They were just going to close all that up, and that was it.
So I have a question for the audience. So I was 10 years old when this happened. Was anybody else watching the shooting? Because I watched that live on TV as a 10-year-old boy. How many here saw that shooting?
The shooting of?
The shooting of Oswald by Ruby.
Oh, yeah.
That was live television. Can you imagine now? You know, I mean, they don't have shootings on live television. Well, they do.
So one more question.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you.
We all remember, too, where we were when JFK was killed, right? If we're old enough, which, of course, I am.
Thank you. There was another celebrity killed around the same time. I believe it was Kim Novak. No. Who was it? Okay, well, yeah. Is it Nina Simone? I'm trying to remember because I have a lousy memory. But that was supposedly a suicide that also looked very funny.
You mean Marilyn?
Marilyn Monroe. No.
No, not Marilyn. No, I don't think so. There has been misinformation out there about a woman, Florence was her name, Florence Smith, who they said that Dorothy had shared all of her JFK assassination evidence with, but there's no evidence that that took place. And you have to think about this. There was only, couldn't go down to FedEx or Kinko's and copy everything. There were only carbons back then. So there was only one copy of that file, but I'm going to find that file. No, I don't think they have. I think I think they found that file and other evidence, and that's why they covered this up.
That's one of the nice things about bureaucracies is they keep all kinds of evidence that you wouldn't believe that they still have.
Yeah. I've always wondered, what do you think the true motivation of Ruby was to kill Oswald? He knew he was probably going to get, you know, the gas chamber, something. Why would somebody be dumb enough to do something like that?
Well, if you do what Dorothy did and look into him, he was really one to be a big shot. In fact, Joe Tannehill talks about that in an interview about him wanting to be more important. You know, he was a wannabe guy, and he was a low-level mafia guy. Hell, the first person to go to Jack Ruby, here's a clue that everybody missed. The first person to visit Jack Ruby at the trial was Joe Savillo, who was Carlos Marcello's mafia underling in Dallas. All right? And so I think that they had Ruby involved. He obviously was short of money. He owed a lot of taxes. They could have paid him to do it. But I think it was mostly because of him wanting to be a big shot. Remember what Joe Tannehill said? He had a classless life. Well, here he is. He's a strip club owner. He's nowhere. And so now he's going to shoot Lee Harvey Oswald and become famous. Dorothy's column, Ruby stars at last. He got to be the big shot he wanted to be, and I think that's probably why he did it. Yes. Yes, sir.
First of all, glad to have a Hoosier speaking also. That's why I wore my Indiana. But question. We're coming up on the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, the women's right to vote. I know that Smithsonian and other organizations are collecting information of famous women in American history. So is there any kind of thought or movement to try and get someone like Dorothy added to that? Because a lot of us my age don't even know about her, and she seems to have made a mark that maybe needs to be brought up again and other women like her.
Well, I would hope that something like that has happened. But I will tell you, even today, it's been tough. I've been a one-man band with this. I love all my readers and people like you that come to hear me, and you know, and hopefully Dorothy's gotten back some of the respect she deserves and all of that. But there's a lot of people out there, believe me, who don't give a darn about the JFK assassination, and they care less about like somebody like Dorothy Kilgallen. But any opportunity that I could find to be able to promote what she did, most people who learn about her are just absolutely amazed at what she was able to achieve. A college dropout who became the most powerful female voice in America. Just imagine that. It's so inspiring. So I'd like to talk to you about that, if I may.
Like Melania.
What's that?
Oh, it's like Melania.
Ah. Whatever. Whatever.
Do we... Just ask the question. I'll bring it over.
Will you sign your autograph in the book?
Yes, I will sign them. Sometimes I like to say they're probably worth less if I sign them, but I will be glad to. I've heard that, but I'd be honored to. Thank you.
Is there any chance after you're done with this subject you'll look into the World Trade Center collapse?
Well, you know, I get letters from people all the time. It's amazing. And I answer every single email that comes along. And people have these different cases that they bring to me and asking me if I would look into them. And a woman just wrote me the other day about her brother being killed in Arizona, and she's trying to get information from the DA. I'll try to help anybody I can. I've kind of worn myself out a little bit with these last two or three books, so I'm going to take a little time to myself. But if the right situation comes along, I'll certainly look into it. And I don't care what anybody else has found out about something. I'll look into it myself. And I like to, in my books, to make people stop and think and make up their own mind. But yes, I certainly could. Thanks.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion.